Osiris.
Welcome to the guest list. All right, my friends, we are back with the guest list, episode number 2. And I had to bring back my good friend B. Getz, who is joining us from the Bay Area.
Yes, sir. Happy to be back. Great to see you.
You too,
good
man.
To talk to everyone.
And since we last spoke, things have started to open up a little light at the end of the tunnel. Personally, I got to go back to Suwanee Music Park and play with Chapter 2. And also play an entire set with Lettuce, which hadn't happened in many, many years, either thing. So Chapter 2 did play at the Blue Note, but it was a different lineup. The original lineup for Chapter 2 is Adam Deitch, Chris Laughlin, Nigel Hall, and myself. And then Louis Cato ended up in the lineup playing bass originally and then switched to drums. So,
right.
That's like the lineup is pretty much, it circles around those five people, but this time it got to be the OG Chapter 2 with Deitch, which hasn't happened in many years. And then Lettuce performed there. It was called Suwanee Rising, and we did like a whole set of, you know, like material from back in the day that I was a part of, in certain cases wrote and in certain cases played on. So, anyway, it's nice to have played music again. It's nice to like be out there, and it felt fine. I was kind of scared of doing shows again, and also was a little hesitant with the whole concept of the pods.
Sure.
But we had a blast, man. And they did shout out to Paul and the whole like Suwanee team, because they did a great job of making it feel good and natural, but also like keeping things safe. You know,
that's amazing. Yeah, obviously you have a huge history playing music there with various combos. Soul Lives played Suwanee a number of times, and you've done the chapter. First time I ever saw Chapter 2 was one of the first Bear Creeks. And then, of course, you know, playing with Lettuce and the Bear Creek history there. So I wanted to hear just maybe a little bit about what it was like to get on stage and play music for a real audience, like, you know, after the pandemic. We talked off the air about how rabid people are for tickets, for music, for the ability to see their favorite artists. Well, on the other side of that, what was it like to play music to human beings and not like a computer monitor?
It was amazing. I mean, I've been playing a lot of music, but it's just so different when you're playing with actual people. And it's like, you know, I hadn't even plugged into an amp in a year, you know what I mean? Besides, I had done a couple things actually that were, you know, either backyard or really small, but as far as like playing with a full band and like cranking an amp up and playing, I mean, even sound check was like euphoric, you know, also playing with that specific group, you know? And we didn't get to rehearse or anything. We just like did a sound check. And funny is because, and then we got on stage for sound check, and I was like, we were supposed to kind of run through the set, and we just started jamming, and it felt so good that I like couldn't stop, you know? And then Nigel was funny because like he probably hadn't slept at all. They had played the night before, and he was like, we were having so much fun, but then he would be like, stop, we got to like, what the hell are we doing? You know? And I'd be like, oh yeah, we got to like rehearse what we're going to do. So anyway, it was so much fun. And I also have been, I have a new guitar that I had never like played really like loud through an amp, you know? So there was all this new stuff going on for me. And my son was there for the first time ever being at a concert, and my wife and my son were there. And, it was actually like the pod thing was kind of cool. And I'm curious, how that will affect the future, because people really liked the pods. I mean, I think that in the future, like VIP pods, and I don't know, I'm always torn on like the VIP thing, you know?
Right.
But you know, my wife was there with like her folks and like her little crew, and they had like their own little cooler and their own little space and like chairs. And for them, it was actually kind of a nice experience, even regardless of COVID or not. I mean, we're all vaccinated, so we were like fairly comfortable anyway. But I was thinking like in the future when things do kind of go back somewhat normal, that people might adapt some of that. I mean, I hope that it's done in a way where it's still, there's still like the energy, the right energy. You know, you want people dancing in front of the stage, but right. I think that people may start doing that anyway. You know, I don't know. Have you been to any live music really?
Only went to see Lettuce on my birthday at Cervantes, which was an indoor, like tables and they were diligent and very, I would say strict,
yeah,
with kind of like enforcing the separation and stuff. And we were very nervous. The only reason I did that is because it was on my birthday and
yeah,
obviously the Lettuce, and it just felt like the right thing to do. But no, we haven't done any of that. I guess this weekend at Terrapin will be kind of like my first outdoor concert experience.
Yeah.
So, but I did watch, you know, there was lots of streaming, people on their phones, and then some people made some great videos of Swanee. So in addition to getting a chance to see you play all that music through the computer, there were like, you know, panning shots of the audience and sort of like little people's personal vantage points, or like, here's our pod. So I did get a dose of, you know, what was the situation with the separation. And yeah, I heard great things. I wonder, without getting all bogged down on it, like cost effectiveness, and is it sustainable for events moving forward? And then of course, you know, when you start creating separate boxes versus the general population, that's the kind of division, like you mentioned with the VIP thing. So I hope they can find a way to incorporate that, so people like your, you know, infant son and wife and grandparents can go and feel safe and feel separate, and then also keep the rage, keep that.
That's
energy
all, that
of
is hard to do, man.
There.
You know, I was actually thinking about this because one time, and we were not completely informed on this situation back then, but we played a Hendrix tribute in Central Park, and we were rehearsing. It was like Soul Live and like, who else was with us? It was like us performing with like Living Color and like all these different people. And like, we were that kind of the house band and Schofield, and it was like it was Hendrix, you know what I mean? So we went out like the rehearsal, we were like going for it. Da, 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 da. And I remember stepping out on stage and like kicking into it and looking out, and the first like 10 or 100 yards, like a couple hundred feet, were like tables with like people eating dinner. Cause it right. was the donors for the Central Park summer stage. And for some reason that just never clicked in my head. And so you had all these people like hundreds of yards, like 100 yards back, like woo, raging. And then all the people in front were like sitting, sipping their like tea and shit. And this, I've experienced that at the Hollywood Bowl, because like the first like, I don't know, 15, 20 rows is all like the donors for the season, you know? And
was
then you have
James
the ragers
Brown,
in the back.
D'Angelo thing?
You know, like I that? Can't remember if they did it for that. I know that when we played the Playboy Jazz Fest, it was okay. The same kind of thing where the stage rotates and each band gets set up and then rotates. And I remember getting on that stage not knowing, and it rotates around. And we were backstage. When you're backstage, you only see like the people up on the hill, and it's like packed, you know. And then we turn around and we kick into the first note, and we realize that most of the people that are right there are just sitting, eating and drinking, you know, rosé or whatever. So anyway, I don't know how to arrange it, but I will say that, you know, I went out there and hung out with my family, like, and it was nice to have like a pod, you know. I was like thinking about, oh man, all the festivals over the years that like, it'd be, you know, usually I watch from either side stage where it sounds like crap, or at front of house where you can't really see, you know, cause I like having my space, you know. But as a performer, sure. You know, you want to have people, you know, getting down. So I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what the answer is, but
Yes, yeah, Suwannee is a good tester for that also. I think that my favorite place really to see any of y'all play is the amphitheater stage there.
Yes.
Just like the acoustics and the sort of alchemy of the trees and the Spanish moss and the energy. And there's just so much at play. And part of that is being in close proximity with lots of other ragers.
Yeah.
The energy exchange is like not really like no other venue that I've been to, like being 5, 6, 7 feet from the amp stage when it's going off.
I agree.
That would be my concern with the pods thing is do we sacrifice that, that electricity? And I don't know. I'm sure they're going to, you know, Paul and them are going to try everything. So
yeah. Yeah. They did a great job. I was hesitant, like I said, but we got there and we had a blast and the music felt great. And it kind of felt like we were back, you know, and I can say that there's been times in this past year where I thought that would never happen. It was like, you know, I was right. losing hope, you know, so I feel really, really good about it. And this weekend I'm going to be up playing with Phil. By the time you guys hear this, it will have already happened, but, that'll be, you know, I'm curious to see how that works out at Terrapin. They've started doing outdoor shows and people are starting to do that. And we just announced that I'm going to be playing with a new project at Red Rocks in May.
Yeah. Talk about that a little bit. What's up with the assembly?
The assembly is like, you know, that name is, it just kind of came together as I kept saying, like, I'm assembling my West Coast band and my favorite cats out here. And I had spoken with you a little bit about names because I'm always so bad at that. But I feel like it also kind of brings to the whole idea of bringing together, because I have had so many projects and so many different records. I mean, we're going to focus on this new record initially, but the idea is that everyone in the band, it sings and like leads, you know, and I really want that to be a focal point, like that at different points in the show, you know, there's going to be a different singer, you know, and also we'll have instrumentals and it'll be like a really interesting mix of styles. So I'm excited to work with all these cats. Otis McDonald, who I've been working with a ton, is like going to be a part of it. Will Blades, who I've been working with a lot over the years. James the Eighth, who some people don't know yet, but he's like, I've been producing his record. So it's a lot of the people I've been like hanging with over the last year. It's been like my little crew of West Coast guys. And then Curtis Kelly, I met kind of recently, incredible drummer and singer. Everyone in the band is like a multi-instrumentalist too. So I'm excited to see how that unfolds, like in terms of, you know, switching things up on stage and like exploring a lot of possibilities. So yeah, I'm really stoked. It's interesting to have the first gig be at a place like Red Rocks. But you know, when we got the offer, I was like,
insane.
I was like, you know, why not? Let's test it out there. And then when things open up, we plan to get it out there. And we have two different. I have an instrumental project called King Canyon that's going to be released this summer. And then I'm going to start releasing singles for my album, which will come out in the fall. So I have like so much music in the vault, like ready to go. So this band will be like a vehicle for like all of it, you know?
So I love that. And I think it's an interesting, just like my take on it is you as a player, as an artist, your last record was a concept album about Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like kind of light years away from what you'd done in the past. I love it. We've talked about that. But then since then, you've moved to Southern California and, you know, you got married, have a young son. You just mentioned your new guitar and then all this new music. So it's great that you have a like sort of fresh assembly of cats from out here. You know, Will's a Bay Area guy, live in L.A. Otis McDonald's up here. You're down there. In LA, I just think it's appropriate for this chapter in your life and in of your music. So I'm really excited about it. I'm glad I got a front row seat and it's right in my backyard, if you will.
Yeah.
So
yeah, Yeah, I'm excited to. I also, you know, having a band that's like, you know, obviously Otis is in the Bay, but having guys that are in California where we can get together, we can play. And it's for me, the vibe is so much of it. It's the music, and it's also great that we're all friends. Like Joe, right. Will introduced me to Otis initially. Otis introduced me to Curtis. I introduced James into the whole thing. It's not like I'm like auditioning people. These are all guys I've been making music with. So it was just natural. It just so happens that they play the right instruments to create a band. You know what I mean? You know, which is always the best. It's kind of like Lettuce was the same way back in the day. We were hanging out all the time regardless. So it was like, we might as well gig. You know what I mean? It always feels good when the band is like friends, you know, first and foremost. I've been listening to the Steve Parrish book or the audio book in this past couple of weeks, and been like, so I'm always inspired by the Grateful Dead in a lot of ways, but the way that I've always like loved when a band is a community of people, you know what I mean? And that actually are not, it's not a business venture. And that's so hard to do. Like, 'cause once things do become a business, you know, I mean, Lettuce has done a good job of like navigating that. But it's hard. It's hard to like be in a band with your friends and sustain it for a really long time. But, you know, I think the one good thing about this band is that at least a few of us have been doing it a long time and know how to do it, you know?
Right.
Anyway, so it's all exciting stuff. Excited.
That's the dream
start.
When you're growing up. Right,
yeah.
Is to be in a band with the homies. It's not like we're going to find this instrument or that. It's like a gang.
Yes, yes. Oh, this is a good segue, actually, because one of the things we wanted to talk about today was the Philly crew and Questlove and the Roots. As most people that are listening to this know, Questlove did a two-part interview on the Plus One show. And we covered a lot. In fact, this might be something that we talk about in a few episodes on the guest list.
Okay.
But I figured we'd get into a little bit, you being a Philly native, me also being like a major Philly music fan, but also a Roots fan, a Soulquarians fan, and obviously a huge fan of Voodoo, the Soultronics, D'Angelo in general. So, yeah, it was great to have him on the show. He's been a huge supporter of me and all of my projects for many, many years, which is like so cool to me because I was a fan of his way before I met him or anything. He and I have worked together on a bunch of projects. I first met him in the studio in Philly way back in the day. Larry Gold.
Larry Gold.
Larry Gold Studio. The string. Yeah. So Larry Gold, they were set up in Larry Gold. And I think he still has a room there for years and years. They were working on a Common album. And the girl I was dating at the time, like, knew them. It actually was through her, now that I think about it. And she brought me there. And it was funny because I think actually, you know, they didn't expect her to bring a boyfriend is really, you know what I mean? And like, she like, was like, this is my boyfriend. At first they're like, who is this dude, you know? And then someone in the room, it might have been Common, had new Soul Live, you know? And they're like, yo. And then we were just starting out, and I think, you know, I don't know if Quest had heard us. A lot of weed being smoked at that moment. But I met him there, and then we became friends, and, you know, Soul Live started opening for them, and Black Thought ended up being on our album, and I ended up playing in a lot of these Roots jams and like the Black Lily things that were going on. So it was just like a really cool community. And it was, you know, very much for Soul Live, especially, was like something we looked up to in terms of like them being artists themselves, but also, you know, kind of bringing this whole scene of other artists and being a breeding ground for talent. So that was like something we looked at and we're like, man, we need to find a way for us to do something similar. And it also goes back to like Philly International, you know, which also looks to Motown and Stax. You know, it's a different scene, but the Roots were their own version of that, you know?
Definitely.
They always had like the hottest new like singer or rapper hanging around.
It's interesting you bring up that time period. I mean, this is like so up my alley, you know, like it's my world. So I want to start by saying like, I love, obviously, the Questlove story, just his journey. And I've listened to a number of his podcasts, including his Questlove Supreme all the time.
Yep.
And he's been on Rick Rubin's pod, et cetera. And again, much like Mayer, it was amazing and fulfilling to hear Quest speak to a peer, to somebody he makes music with, who he's like can compare tour stories with. It's a different version of him that he brought to this conversation where speaking to one of his own, like somebody from his generation who's made music with the same people. And, you know, I devour anything Roots, anything D'Angelo related as an amateur musicologist myself. So to hear him, you know, for two episodes, speak to you with such detail and personal touch about what was happening when in the studio, in his own home with his sister and his parents. I mean, again, this is stuff that he's intimated or mentioned, but the way he related the stories to you was really incredible because he's talking to a friend, to a peer. And so I've been through the pods a couple times just to make sure I got every last little nugget, you know?
Yeah.
And you bring up the community, and we were talking about like Jambase and the online thing and how that affected the jam band community last week when we were talking about Mayer.
Yeah.
Well, they did it too with OK Player. And that was kind of how I got in is my homies were like all about OK Player. We were, you know, I grew up in South Jersey. We used to take the train over the high speed line to Philly. The skaters would hit Love Park. We'd roll to South Street, go into like Zipperhead punk rock store, get a cheesesteak at Jim's.
Yeah.
And on the weekends there would be this drummer with an afro, or at the time he had like little baby dreads afro.
Yeah.
And some rappers and a bass player. And we didn't know what the square roots were.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like 92, 93 cheesesteak skate runs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then fast forward to May of 95, and the Beastie Boys were on tour, Ill Communication, and they had the Roots open, the Philly Civic Center. So like we went to the show to see the Beasties, and it's like, holy shit, there's those dudes by Jim Steaks
opening
the show. So that's kind of how we got plugged in locally. And then years later with OK Player, my homies from Philly and Jersey were all about it. They were like, you got to check out this website. It's right up your alley. And they had like, you know, primitive message boards. You know, they had the OK Artist section, make the music for producers.
Yeah.
General discussion for non-music and the lesson. And I'll tell you, man, like I spent years of my life in the lesson. And Quest was in the lesson. And occasionally Quali or a Badu. But then like thousands of us just trading stories, information. This is before social media. So this is how like music heads communicated. And Quest shepherded that. He posted regularly. He shared his Voodoo tour diaries, all that kind of stuff. And it just, you know, it was like an amazing thing to be a part of, like, OK Player. So that's how I found out about Black Lily. Tuesday night, it's at the Five Spot.
Yep.
I probably saw you play there.
I used to go down there. Yeah, I would go down there with my friend who was a DJ. Even before, man, this is so far back. This is when I was in college. So in the 90s for sure. But man, those were so much fun. And then at the Wetlands, they used to host it too. So as soon as I moved to New York, that was like my hang was the Wetlands. And it was so cool because the Wetlands, I got to know everybody pretty fast because Lettuce and Soul Live would play there. That was like our beginnings. We're playing initially in that basement of the Wetlands. Right. And then we started doing the main stage and then we got a residency. So I got to know all the bouncers and everybody there. So when those would be going on, they would just like open the back door for me, you know, and I'd like be hanging out back there. And like, it was just kind of an open invite to get on stage during the jam sessions. And yeah, it was so cool. It's funny how looking back at it, it was such a diverse scene too. Cause like we, yeah. I mean, Soul Live would play one night and we'd have like Reuben Wilson and Idris Muhammad came down and Bernard Purdy wow. and Melvin Sparks. And then the next night would be like The Roots and Black Lily and like Badu would show up and things like that. And then it would be like more like the jam band. Like I remember that, like in that same week, the Frog Wings would play with like Derek when he was a kid. And those were pretty epic times.
Yes. During, and the seeds.
Yeah.
They were the seeds for everything that we talk about.
Yeah.
Were sown there. I mean, early Derek Chuck shows there. You had all the Slip shows there.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, you had the hip hop with The Roots and their jams and Black Lily. And then, of course, all the early Lettuce, Soul Life stuff, all in that little, you know, room, there was like a Grateful Dead bar that just kind of took on a life of its own. Again, it all kind of comes back to Dead culture, even this.
Yeah.
You know, because all the seeds for the Soulquarians and Electric Lady, they're all sown at those jams. And again, Quest bringing you back to that, bringing you back to those formative times. How, like, I've heard him tell the D'Angelo story about how he played, you know, the little lick from Madhouse to get his attention. But what I didn't know is that he dismissed him because his Tims were dirty. That is like the most amazing fucking detail.
That's funny.
He's not on Brown Sugar because he came in the studio with dirty Tims.
Yeah.
And I think only you would get that note.
That's really funny. And like, you know, he also was like, you know, R&B at that time had gotten so slick. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And kind of corny. So if you said you were an R&B singer, it was like people were kind of like, you know, because everyone that was coming out then was so clean. You know what I mean? And it had lost a lot of its grit. And D'Angelo brought that. And I think the first album, Brown Sugar, was dope. I mean, I listened to that record a ton. But then when Voodoo came out, I was like, I mean, this is everyone will say the same thing. When Voodoo came out, it was a complete game changer. I mean, Brown Sugar also was a game changer, actually. I really want to be real because it was hip hop with like the greatest singer ever on it. But Voodoo will always stand and it's always stand the test of time. And it will also always like be this like pivot in soul music or music in general. The way they changed the feel. And it was interesting. I got to insert a little bit from the Pino interview that I did. But, I asked him, like, you know, how much Dilla influence? He was like, we loved Dilla. And D'Angelo loved Dilla. But the whole, like, concept of, like, behind the beat and the way that we played was a D'Angelo thing. You know what I mean? Like he was like, it wasn't like we were like listening to Dilla beats and trying to sound like that. This is like what he was doing. And they may have influenced each other. And he's not saying they didn't influence each other, but he was like,
right.
D had that feel. You know what I mean? That was like, and that was really him pushing them to play with that. And also his boldness to like not be afraid to be messed up. Cause I remember when that album came out, a lot of musicians and a lot of people were like, what the hell's going on?
Oh, yeah.
You know, what
Lenny
is
Kravitz
this?
Couldn't play on it. He showed up at the studio and he's like, I can't get with this, which is amazing to me. But it's a true story. But I thought it was interesting how Quest gave you the chronology of, okay, so Bob Power, the guy who made the Tribe drums snap, is the one who was on the D'Angelo tip. And then it was like, Alicia He Muhammad was on Brown Sugar, which is what got Quest's attention. But by the time he got with D'Angelo, D'Angelo was on to the Voodoo style.
Right.
He didn't want to remake the Tribe thing again.
Right.
And I think people were just late to the party, you know. I think everybody kind of scratched their heads. You said it in the episode that it took three listens for you to really get it.
Yeah.
And you hear a lot of people say, well, I don't hear the songs, or he's mumbling, or it's offbeat. I mean, it's no secret. Voodoo's my favorite album, like unequivocally. And it's the type of thing that you're still unpacking all these years later.
Yeah.
I think it's remarkable to hear Quest in that discussion with you give you kind of the genetics of it.
Yeah.
Of how he like unlearned the way to play on Illadelph Half-Life, where he wanted to sound like an NPC.
Yeah.
And then he had to rewire his brain to play Voodoo. But then Erica wanted something different. So yeah. like one day he's playing in one style and another he's playing in another. And then for you to hear that bloom and then another, again, I mean, I made so many notes, but you got into it with him on the Fela thing and how like water for chocolate, it spoon fed Fela to people who really didn't know.
Yeah.
And then from that came this whole revolution of Fela and Afrobeat, not necessarily solely from that album, but from that era, from
it sparked Common and Roy Hargrove. I will say that it sparked it, or their scene sparked it, you know?
Yeah.
Not only that, it, like all these reissues and compilations started coming out, and then the Red Hot and Fela, it was a lot of things kind of maybe bubbling up to that, but it definitely put the Fela thing on the map. Especially that like Water for Chocolate album, you know, even for me, like I knew Fela, oh, yeah. but then after that it was like, okay, I'm diving deep in there. It was also cool to hear him talk about some of the technical stuff of like figuring out how to play, you know, where he was developing his whole style that we know now of like certain miking techniques and playing really soft so that the compressor could like do certain things. So for me as an audio nerd, that was also pretty cool to get some of that. Cause I do remember that, like going in the studio and seeing all these weird things that they were doing and putting him inside this tiny little box and then like miking things super hot and he would play really quiet. Which influenced us because back in the day, you know, the sounds it was always like get a nice room sound. You know, that was the whole thing is like the studio has to have a dope room for the drums. And they were like in this beautiful room in Electric Lady when I came in once and had all these weird boards and gobos surrounding the drum so that he was in this tiny little box. And I was like,
oh, wow.
I was like, holy shit, we're in like the greatest room ever built. And he built this like ghetto box around his drums so it would sound super dry, you know what I mean, which is the voodoo sound. It's like a dry, like you don't hear any air in there, you hear the mic really hot on the drum. So anyway, it was cool to hear him talk about that because I'd seen him do it but never really broken down what was going on. And then there the Roots studio behind the stage there, or you know, at 30 Rock, which I've been in a bunch of times, he has that same thing, a tiny little box around his drums. And their studio is tiny. They're all like, I worked on the Betty Wright album with the Roots. It's like Betty Wright and the Roots. I played guitar on that record. And we did that record in that room. And the engineer's in the same room as the rest of us. And there's a tiny little drum booth. And we're like hitting each other in the head with the like necks of our guitars. And she's like got this little mic and we're recording in this tiny little room. And I'm always thinking in my head, like, oh, the Roots are like always in Electric Lady or some dope studio. But most of the recordings you hear from the last like 10 years are them in that little space. Which is crazy.
That's a cool nugget, man. I would have never guessed, especially Quest being such a big guy, you know, getting in a tiny space, but you know, that's awesome. And those are the type of nuggets we love to hear because the drum sounds on that album like revolutionized music.
Oh,
because the whole like neo soul movement and everything that kind of came out of that, which has been aped and imitated so many times over, was really born on that. And really that whole scene that he set, you know, where he has Erica in the C Studio C and Com and B and Voodoo and A, and Dilla bouncing around with ideas, playing 45 minutes of left-handed bass lines while they watch JFK. Like, all that kind of stuff. And then you realize what comes out of that. All the records, you know, Things Fall Apart, Voodoo, Mama's Gun, like Water for Chocolate, Bilal, Jill Scott, you know, et cetera. Yeah. Black Lily, The Wetlands. I like to think that, like, the family that you're a part of, that you're, you know, co-founder of, Lettuce, Soul Live, Royal Family, is almost like molded in the spirit of that.
Absolutely.
You know, like a connectivity. And you hear it in the music. The first time I noticed it was when Soul Live played the original rework of Rule the World with Nigel, Creek. And it felt like it was such a, like a baton passing of, like, in theory and on stage, of just that energy and that connectivity amongst people in the culture, and look at where everybody's gone from that family and what everyone's doing and all these different projects and stuff. It's not unlike the Soulquarian blueprint.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And it's like I said, it goes back to like Motown and Stax, and like that's what I grew up on. And it was, that's why the Roots were so important to me, was beyond just their albums. It's like they were creating like our version of that in real time. You know what I mean? So it was like I was a fan of anything their crew was putting out. So, you know, that's what we've tried to create. I think our version of it has been a little bit more broken up and all over the place. But, you know, that was the whole idea of Royal Family. And
so is theirs, though. Yeah. Actually.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You might have even had a longer lasting window than they did.
Right. Right. He said one thing that was really interesting. And, you know, it kind of happened to us, too, is once you put a name on it, it falls apart. Right. You know, like right once we like said, this is Royal Family, it started falling apart, because then you like have to create a business around it. You know what I mean? Once they called it Soulquarians, people were like, wait, why are you using this name, and who owns it, and who? And it was the same thing for us. It was like, okay, it's Royal Family. And people were like, all right, well, who owns it, and how do we buy it? Like, then it was like, oh shit, trademarks. Oh, how do we, all of a sudden it was like cease and desist, because there's a Royal Family, whatever. And we're like, oh man, you know, it's so hard to, once you put a name on it and make a business out of something that comes straight up from just feeling, you know what I mean? And total creative vibes. It's always hard to, like, this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, which is like, it's always hard to balance like that combination of like business and like this like creative family thing. But they've done well with it. You know, obviously there's been a lot of ups and downs, and, you know, Rich Nichols, when he passed away, he was a big piece to this. A lot of people don't know about him, but he was actually, for me, also like a really important person. Like, he would bring me in on a lot of things. Like, I mean, Quest also did, but Rich would be the one who would reach out to me about doing stuff with the Roots. One of the things being, we actually did like the legendary 4th of July Philly free concert with like hundreds of thousands of people. And we got to do this like long set with Michael McDonald, Earth, Wind & Fire, the Isley, not the Isleys, the Levert crew. It was basically like a version of the OJs, but, man, getting to do all of those tunes with the Roots was like epic for me. So anyway, I'm super thankful for Rich. It was really sad when he passed away. Another little nugget was that Rich called me into the studio when, I don't know if I talked about this with Quest, but I played on the Al Green record that Quest and Poyser, I don't know if they technically produced it. I think, they produced it, and they were the band.
They did.
I played on that after Spanky died, because Spanky Alford was the guitar player on that record, and he passed away before it was done. So the last couple sessions I came in and played, and one of the tracks was Al Green and Sharon Jones doing a cover of Crazy, of the CeeLo to Gnarls Barkley. And we did like a 6/8 version of that I played on. And that was like Rich's whole idea. That song never came out. And I'm to this day trying to find like a mix of it, because I didn't get to leave the studio with a copy. But that was a pretty epic session with those guys. But and then another guy in that whole scene, Russ Elevato, I met Russ, you know, through them, which then he ended up engineering my album, Blood from a Stone. But he also worked on a lot of the Quali stuff that I did, and as another member of like our whole crew now, obviously now working with Lettuce, and he's definitely
those are unsung heroes.
Yeah,
right there. Rich Nichols, I'm glad you brought that up, because he's such an important part of the story, and I was glad that Quest was able to talk so personally and profoundly about Rich's ideas. Like, again, the way he took us back to April 94, the bidding war for the Roots, Cobain takes his life, Guns N' Roses out of pocket, and why they were like, we're taking the bag, the money, and we're going to London on a Hendrix trip. Rich Nichols, brilliant.
Yeah,
I mean, just incredible move that worked out for them so well that none of the guys in the group would have ever thought of to do.
Right.
And again, Rich was a pioneer with OK Player, and such an important person in that Philly music community that you were talking about with Black Lily and just the heritage, Larry Gold. Yeah. Rich was, yeah, like the way he pick up the phone and call you is just indicative of how connected and just how beloved he was and the way he treated people. And I remember he had a long and very debilitating illness and sad day when that happened. And also speaking of unfortunate passings, Spanky is one of the most underappreciated guitarists, at least in my world. And to be asked to come in and finish his parts on an Al Green record is what an honor.
Yeah. Man. I don't think I even deserved it by any means, looking back at it at that time, but man, it was so cool. And Spanky was a fan of Soul Live, which was just the most crazy thing ever. And I was literally his biggest fan on the planet. We were in North Sea at the North Sea Jazz Fest and the Voodoo Tour. Actually, no, he was playing with Roy Hargrove, I think, at the time. But he was there and he came to see Soul Live and then we ended up hanging out pretty much the whole weekend. You know, the North Sea Jazz Fest is like this thing where like the musicians hang all weekend and there's these jam sessions. And we had recently toured with George Benson, who was his hero. And I got to bring him backstage to meet George Benson, which was like the crazy. And he was like, oh my God, he was so, so excited. And then he actually came to my room and we had this like whole, like kind of what I consider a lesson, you know, I mean, he came over to like jam in my room. We just had our guitars and I recorded it on like an old Nokia phone that I kept for so many years and I had lost it in a move, which was like the biggest loss of my life. Anyway, but I got to hang with Spanky during that time, which was such a cool experience. And actually one of the jam sessions, Deitch was there with Schofield and Soul Live was there. And Deitch and I went to the jam session, which had like everybody. It was like, you had to have an artist pass to go to the jam session at North Sea, which I don't know if they still do that, but that made it so cool because every artist would show up. So like one night it was Lil Jon on drums, who we had grown up watching.
Oh, wow.
It was
Janet Jackson drummer.
Yes. And he went to Berkeley with us. George Benson ended up sitting in. Herbie was there.
Oh, man.
I smoked a joint with Randy Brecker. who else was there? D'Angelo, Badu. I don't know. I know Badu got on stage. Roy Hargrove. All these people hanging in a little bar. And Deitch got up and played at one point. I was too scared. I did not get up there. I don't know who was on stage with Deitch at the time, but it was just a revolving. But yeah. I watched George Benson get on stage and like grab some guy's Telecaster, and I'd never heard him on like a Telecaster, and just burned the place to the ground. And then like Deitch was like, get up there. I was like, never, never in a million years will I ever play after George Benson. There's just no way. But that was such a cool experience. Again, just like throwback to those times. And I'm super thankful to have met those guys and been able to play with them. We also did a few shows under the name The Concept, which I don't know if we talked about that.
Now, I saw that band.
In New York or at...
Well, you played back-to-back nights in TLA and BB King's. I went to both.
Oh, wow. Crazy.
Yeah, so, me and my boy. We did a jam bass article on it both nights. My boy Robbie, who I grew up with, went to Hebrew school with. He did the BB King's night, and I wrote up the TLA.
Okay, you should send me that article if you get a chance. I have to mention Sharky, too, because Isaiah Sharky, I remember I was in the studio working on Blood from a Stone with Russ Alavado, and he was like, you want to hear the new D stuff? And we all were like, are you kidding me? Voodoo had come out in 2000. This was 2012, yep. I think. He had like 40 songs on a hard drive, you know, only 10 of which or whatever were on the Black Messiah. And most of what was on that record we did here, but he just played music for 4 hours in Right Track Studios. Because basically what was happening is D had Right Track Studios and Russ on the days between, because like they had it locked out and they had all their gear in there. And on the days between, he would hit me up, be like, hey, let's work. And I'd bring my record, because I had recorded most of my record. I was just overdubbing and mixing. And like Zoidus would come down and whoever, and we would like sit in there with Russ and mix like on the days between. All D's stuff was set up and everything. So like after we'd be working for a while, he'd be like, you want to hear something? We'd be like, yes. And then he played some of those tracks and I just kept being like, how did they have all this spanky guitar stuff? This must have been recorded so long ago. And then he was like, no, that's Isaiah Sharkey. And then he also had the name. He was like, that's Sharkey. And I was like, oh, he's saying spanky wrong, you know? And I was like, no, right. That's spanky, bro. And then he was like, and then I realized, no, this is another dude. And he sounded so much like him.
Yeah.
I was like, where did you find someone that sounded like Spanky? There's only like, I'd never heard anyone sound like him.
Do you know the story, how they found him?
He was in like a music shop.
A guitar store.
Yeah.
Yeah. And D'Angelo's like, the ghost of Spanky is in this store.
Yeah.
And it was Isaiah.
And his name is Sharkey.
Right.
It's so crazy. I need to get him on the show. I've talked to him about it. I need to actually just make that happen. But it's such a cool, it's just great to see like people carry that torch. And he's just like, you know, it's crazy that D finds people, you know, like that. I mean, I think also people gravitate toward him because every musician on earth is a fan, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The Sharkey. And then of course, Jesse Johnson is an amazing guitar player too, but he's nothing like, cause they used to have Jeff Lee Johnson. That was the Soultronics other.
Yeah.
And the chemistry is similar. Cause Jeff Lee was like the pimp and the feathers wiling out like Prince and Hendrix, while Spanky was the church guy in the back, just playing the stankest riffs ever.
Yeah.
And you kind of have that same dichotomy with Sharkey being the kind of prim, proper, reserved. And Jesse's like rhinestoned out glitter, wiling out on some Hendrix. So, yeah, D'Angelo somehow pulls these cats. And it's interesting because he didn't, for whatever reason, I know there's like business stuff. And Quest talked a lot about the disappointment of D'Angelo, struggles and him disappearing and the fear and the anxiety. And you can actually, you know, in the film, you see a lot of that in the documentary about D'Angelo. You see like up close his fears, his anxieties and stuff. So for whatever reasons, and it's not important, he didn't go with Quest on Black Messiah. You know, he used him for one song, used James Gadson for one song, but it's mostly Chris Dave.
Yeah.
And it's a different sound.
Yeah.
I mean, the Vanguard really doesn't sound a whole lot like the Soultronics, even the same
and
songs.
I like both. I mean, I'm always going to be partial to the Voodoo.
Right. Same.
You know, it's just how it is. You know, some people like Black Messiah. I love both, but, you know, Voodoo to me, it was also just because it was the first of its kind. Right.
Changed everything.
Yeah, but anything D'Angelo does, you know, I'm all in. And Quest, you know, I also got to do the gigs with him and Booker T when he and Gabe Roth together, I think produced that when Booker T made a solo record, Booker T under Booker T Jones. And the band was Quest, myself, Booker T, Christian McBride, and Gary Bartz. And I need to see if there's live recordings of that, but that was really, really amazing to play like the old Booker T and the MG's stuff. We played some Gary Bartz stuff. But Quest just crushed that. It was such a light. He like knew exactly what to do on that stuff. And that's also a great record, that Booker T record.
Yep. It won a Grammy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was,
what was the concept like? I mean, for you, because I look back at that, it's GPJ, it's Porter.
Yeah.
Right. And you and Quest, and we talk about Jazz Fest and the jam scene and the festival scene and obviously tracing the roots to the Wetlands and Black Lily. I mean, that's like a pivotal thing because a lot has happened in the aftermath. Like, you know, George becomes this sort of celebrated, you know, patriarch of the community. And Quest is this musicologist who touches on all these different projects. And then you, of course, we talked about whether it's the Dead World or Soulive or Lettuce or hip hop and Quali and the Roots. Do you look back on that concept project as just kind of like a gig?
No.
That you did? Or was it, do you see it as some like pivotal sort of
seed
planting?
Oh, it was absolutely pivotal. The very first version of it was in New Orleans. And I think Paul Peck was the original guy to reach out to me, at least. And then he and I worked on so much stuff together. The Bonnaroo.
He's a man of great ideas.
Yeah. We've done a lot together over the years. So shout out to Paul Peck. The amount of like super jam things we've put together, is insane. But, that first one was where I really met Porter, you know, and I've probably done thousands with Porter, definitely hundreds. It was also where I've linked up with Bill Summers and subsequently got to do a bunch of stuff with him and his version of the Headhunters. I was pretty tight with Ivan already, who did some of those gigs. I think that may have been the first time I played with Quest. We knew each other at that point, but I don't think we'd actually played a show together proper. Yeah. So that really opened a lot of doors for me. And obviously the big one being working with Porter, because he and I have just done like so much since then. But it's funny because then it never really happened again. I remember that last gig being like, all right, this is going to be a thing that we do, you know, not like all the time, but it'd be fun to bring that back one day for sure.
Yeah. And I also appreciated the Quest Bolive stuff because it's obvious Quest is like the way he is about music in general, but specifically James Brown and like Clyde and J-Bo and all that, much like yourself. But so for him, you kind of give him an opportunity to flex that like he doesn't often get. He can't really play that hard funk, obviously, with the Roots or with some of the more R&B oriented stuff. But, you know, to see him get up on stage and just cut loose with Soulive and Nigel doing James Brown, I mean, this is amazing to behold.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, he does that so well. And then when he's come down and guested with Chapter Two a couple times.
Blue Note, right.
At the Blue Note. And we do that. We have to do that, you know, pretty much every time he comes down when Nigel's there, there's like a whole James Brown jam session that goes down. But he's like, you know, like we said in the beginning, he's a historian. He's a musicologist. So it's just on so many levels. He just like retains so much detail in his brain, like from the little breaks to like I've watched him, single out like one horn part out of like a five horn piece, you know, like a five piece horn section, be like, that trumpet's actually a G. And we're all like, he heard that, you know, like it's pretty amazing what he hears, you know. And it's not necessarily because it's really like, it's a combination because he's studied it, but he also obviously has this natural talent and ear. But it's hard to stump that man, you know. And that combination of like his playing and then DJing, you know, because he's always going down the rabbit hole on different artists and whatnot. And it's kind of, so the when you combine all of that together, you know, there's not really, he's an absolutely unique character.
Yeah, exactly. And he's been even more treasured during the pandemic because of the DJ stuff. And just to kind of bring it full circle, like exactly, he hears everything. So when he's DJing on Twitch or YouTube or whatever, Instagram in the beginning, you know, he turned down the sound and explained to you real quick a quick studio nugget or what you're hearing, why that's a 303 and how revolutionary that drum machine was at that moment or whatever. Yeah. It reminds me of the way it was on OK Player, The Lesson.
Yeah,
like just the sharing of nuggets and teaching. And I mean, I kind of like, you know, humbly hope to be like a musicologist in the path of a Questlove, just in telling the stories.
Yeah.
Yourself too. It's like, it's a lost art, liner notes,
Yeah.
Long form journalism, all that stuff in the internet era, short attention spans. We need the Questloves and the Eric Krasnos to tell these stories, because this is history. And this is like our, you know, renaissance, if you will.
Absolutely. And
if it's just a drag and drop and click and copy paste, nobody holds on to that shit. But Quest is a great example of, if you live it, then you know that little hiccup between the 3 and the 4 on that fill.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I know it. I don't even play drums, but because he pointed it out, showed me what it meant, who it's from, why that's really the Curtis Mayfield Mother's Son beat, just slowed down. It's like, okay, I got it
right
now.
Right, right, right. That's the good shit. That's the good shit.
Exactly.
That's the good shit. Well, I think that's a good place to quit it for this particular episode. But man, this has been fun. And we have a lot more coming. I want to give a shout out to everyone that's supporting the guest list. And I want to make sure everyone knows about the Upful Life podcast, which is B's podcast. I've been a guest on there. He's had a lot of great musicians on there. So go ahead and check that out. And thank y'all for listening. Eric Krasno Plus One is hosted by me, Eric Krasno. Executive producers are RJB and Christina Collins. Audio production by Matt Dwyer. Produced by myself and Ben Baruch of 1111 Group. All original music is by me, and most of which are instrumentals from my album, Telescope, under the artist name Kras. This podcast is presented by Osiris Media. If you'd like to get in touch with us, email krasplusone@gmail.com. That's KRAZPLUSONE @gmail.com. Send me some questions. Maybe I'll answer them on air. Send me suggestions of other guests you'd like to hear on the show. Thanks again for tuning in. I'll see you next time. Osiris.